afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Nearly 30 years ago, she was naked, severely burned, fleeing her village. It is a photograph that some believe has. This afternoon is Denise Chong. She is the photograph and the Vietnam War. Listeners, I invite your telephone calls for Denise Chong this afternoon. Here are the numbers. WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222. Denise Chong is the author of the memoir, The Concubine's Children. Her work has appeared in magazines and anthologies, including Canadian publications Saturday Night, and Who Speaks for Canada? The Girl in the Picture is published by Viking. 333-9455, the number in Champaign, Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Denise Chong, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you.
Many, if not most, listeners have seen this photograph. If you have seen it, you will never forget it. But there might be some who are unfamiliar. Could you describe this photograph and its power?
At the heart of the photograph is the stark expression is almost a caricature of horror and pain. Her arms are outstretched. She's running straight into the viewer's eye. And this is the eye of the camera. The back of the camera is uniform, and the black smoke swirls behind them. So you don't know what she's running from. You don't know who those soldiers are affiliated with. You don't know the extent of her injury. So I think that the part of the movie that it evokes although it is, yes, a stark photo from the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, you get people who will work on things, who find their way to the home of the photographer, Nick Ut, in California. They knock on his door and they say, Nicky, you know, I'm here because I want to thank you for taking the picture. But in a sense, it confirmed in America's public mind that this was a war that had to end. They just wanted out. Peace, deal, and left. But show that picture to someone who's from South Vietnam, and they know, no, that war did not end. It continued for 3 more years.
At that moment, you write that the children
Kim remembers it, thinking, well, you know, finally she just wants war to end. She just wants to stop running from mortar fire that she doesn't know where it's coming from. She just wants life to go back to normal. And, of course, if it is anything but that, while Vietnam falls from the radar of the West, in fact, the country then becomes just a crucible for sorting out the torment of after and the aftermath of war as the Northerners take over the South.
Mm. And then there was war with Cambodia.
Yes. I mean, she's 9 months between the napalm attack. She's 12 when the war ends. And in fact, as through her teenage years, it's just one political tumult after another. She has to deal with being on the vanquished side as opposed to the victor. And then while America has its, and the West has its back turned on what was in the tumult.
In the book, you've included another photograph of Kim Phuc that is very moving, a photograph of her with her scarred back exposed to the camera and cradling her baby boy, Thomas. Babe and mom, Madonna-like, really. Thoughts on that picture?
It took me a long time myself to even get Kim to reveal her scars to me. And here she bears it, for the public, first published in Life magazine a few years ago. And it would took days for him to even wear short sleeves then, or something sleeveless in my presence. And you just do a sharp intake of breath when you see those frozen rivers of scar tissue. That picture, in a crass sense, it was Kim's meal ticket. She was down in Canada, living in obscurity, and thought, well, I will go back, reluctantly, to selling my story. And so, besides this picture, which was published in Life magazine, she then sells so much in book rights. However, you're right, this picture, the contrast between the baby, who's asleep on her shoulder, the smooth, perfect skin, and her scarred, burnt, so much so that, ironically, the moment Kim defected, the famous picture is you will find this picture there. Because maybe in that picture of the conflict between the baby's skin is the thought of redemption.
Mm-hmm. And the rebirth of a...
And rebirth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How is Kim Fook and her family today?
She is fine. She's certainly had the best of medical treatment all her life. She's continues to be a victim always of her burns. Her health will always suffer, and it'll be unpredictable. But she's also, in a sense, a victim of goodwill. Good things happen to her too. She is now a spokesman for UNESCO, a goodwill ambassador for peace. She has reconciled herself, and I would say it was partly through the intensity of our research in this book. She has reconciled herself to her iconic image. As much as she desperately, probably still wants to escape that image, it has its hold on her. People will see her, and that photograph will fill every crevice of their mind. Mm-hmm. And then out will come thoughts of the war, the torment of war, and its victims.
Mm-hmm. What are her feelings about journalists?
Well, when I met her and I first began the book, she was living in obscurity in the West when the long lens of a tabloid photographer in London found her on this Toronto street, and then ensued a media feeding frenzy. And there I got to witness firsthand her just revulsion at the first look of a journalist. Notebook in hand, maybe the waiting taxi, the camera strap over the shoulder. Because her first reaction is what she experienced in Vietnam when she was used as a propaganda tool. There she would be out something while hiding everything inside, masking what she actually felt inside. I think now her living in the West and working with me on this book to say it's okay, you can spill your thoughts. I can ask you questions, you can delve and you can probe into the answers. She's much more open with the idea of journalism, and now, in a curious way, sees herself using journalists to even exploit the image to put forward her own message about how she thinks about victims of war.
How was it that you met her and the two of you began to think about doing this book?
I got a call simply out of the blue from my publisher of my memoir, The Concubine's Children. Do you remember the famous photograph, The Concubines, from the Vietnam War, the little girl running naked? Well, of course, immediately. And it turned out when I met Kim, she was living on social assistance. She was going to a food bank. She would send her husband out on garbage collection days to scavenge for broken furniture. So, like that sale of the photo to Life magazine, she thought, naively, I can sell my book rights and then resume a normal life. So it was financial for her. And then the question really was, could I write this book? Could I make her peer over the edge of this little cup she lived in. She had defected, but I almost thought she was living in a cup of communism, because that's the regime that she'd come from. And then could I have the courage to revisit and fill out that landscape of war? And would I get into Vietnam trying to research a book about someone who had defected in the eyes of the Vietnamese regime to the enemy, to the West, who had manufactured napalm? And all that did come together, and it took us a period of years to lay out this story.
The proceeds of the book, is she sharing in them?
Yes, she shares in the proceeds. And she shares in the proceeds of a film that is being that is already out on her. She takes the book on speaking tours. She speaks quite frequently on both her own association with a foundation named after the Child Victims of War and on behalf of UNESCO.
Mm-hmm. She's still living in the Toronto area?
She lives outside of Toronto now, within view of her church. She's deeply, deeply religious. She has her parents living with her. In some ways, she's at first glance like the typical refugee that arrives with nothing but the clothes on their back. And then 3 years later, a few years later, 5 years later, there's a used car in the driveway, down payment on a townhouse, washer dryer in the basement. But she has this whole other life as an icon, as I've described it, which is almost perhaps none of us can identify with. And I'll illustrate it by this example. I called her in August because I wanted to catch up on summer vacations. And I'm telling her that my husband and I have taken our two children to the ocean, we've been swimming in the Pacific Ocean, gone to see my mother. And then I say, Kim, how was your summer? And she says, Dan, I'm so excited. She says, I've just had an audience with the Queen. So, end of my story of my summer vacation. Mm-hmm. But she leads this other very, very different life.
Tell us briefly how it is she came to live in Canada. Take us through this perfect
Well, the war ends, and she fades into, as Vietnam does, into obscurity from the West point of view, until a day in 1982 that a communist official knocks on her classroom door and calls her out and says they're looking for the girl in the picture. And they look at her and they say, you? You're the girl in the picture? And Kim immediately understands. She simply draws up her left sleeve to reveal the burn scar. Well, that then begins a treadmill of her being used as a propaganda tool to argue against American aggression, American involvement in the Vietnam War, so Vietnam can argue for reparations. And she is trotted out then for what is probably hundreds, if not thousands, of interviews because people keep reaching for the girl on the picture. And she is minded. She is told what to say. She endures years of this until she is right under the thumb that she is moved from her school. She is penniless. She can't even afford ice for her back. Burns that much less a painkiller. And in desperation, she then finally appears at someone caught in the Vietnamese regime who says, all right, the solution is to get you out of reach of the journalists, and in particular, American journalists who are coming to look for you. Where can we send you? Cuba. But she languishes in Cuba because Cuba slides downhill because of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And then Kim faces the prospect of thinking, I will never be free of a minder. I will always be under their control. I have to go back to Vietnam eventually. I have to escape. She gets into my escape. And that opportunity comes when she marries a Vietnamese student in Havana. The regime gives them permission, the Vietnamese regime gives them permission to honeymoon in Moscow. The plane from Moscow returning to Havana refuels in Dunedin, Newfoundland, Canada, and she steps off and seeks refugee status.
Mm-hmm. Did she have it in mind all the time?
She knew nothing of Canada, but that it was a little maple leaf pin on a for a flag pin. She understood it was coral, but what she has on her mind is escape, because she is overwhelmed by her suffering, and not just physical suffering, because I think we in the West understand physical suffering, but this is suffering of a different sort. This is state repression, state humiliation, state control. And when that just eats her up, she thinks escape, and she thinks escape to the West. And so she's prepared to flee from her cage, no matter where that is, and chance happens that it's Canada.
Kim and her family lived in the village of Trang Bang.
Yes.
And this is a village northwest of what was then Saigon. And it's on the highway from what is now Ho Chi Minh City to Phnom Penh, Cambodia. Talk with us, if you would, about what life was like in the village when Kim was a little girl.
The route one out of Saigon that heads west towards Phnom Penh eventually reaches very dense jungle and overgrowth. Along that route were little clusters of buildings that you could hardly call towns, and that's what Trang Bang is, a little cluster. Except that this corridor echoes with the footsteps of war. So you would see when Kim was a child, French Citroëns and Peugeots flying their way. And then eventually in her earliest girlhood are AMC trucks. So it's American trucks and military trucks plying this highway. And it's carrying, you know, time-honored goods out of Cambodia, from dishes to silk and cigarettes, fish, rice. It's traveling this route. But it's two worlds. One is by day, one is by night. By night, the hour belongs to the Viet Cong. And even a child knows, therefore, that there is a safe time and an unsafe time. By day, you can greet government soldiers. By night, you risk, if you're out, assassination, robbery, kidnapping, torture, being taken prisoner by the Viet Cong. But you can lead a very normal life. But the difference is that for children and adults, Kim's mother would go every day to her noodle shop. She was a famous cook and a noodle shop maker, but mainly because her shop was a watering hole for people traveling between Saigon and the border. Kim thinks, you know, as her father hoses down the hogs and pops them out and mother gets noodle shop, but they're just peasants. They lead a normal life. And what she doesn't know, and she would not know until she read my book, in fact, as she lies sleeping in her hammock in the bomb shelter under the house, is a wounded Viet Cong being sheltered. Or there's a knock at the door in the night, and the Viet Cong has come to invite her sister to go out to the jungle, because she can read and write, to read aloud execution orders for condemned prisoners. Or that her mother at the noodle shop is in fact forced to run messages for the Viet Cong and keep tallies of the movements of government troops. Kim would not learn that until she actually read the book. So parents protected children, tried to give them some normal life.
Yeah. In the book, you begin a chapter with two Vietnamese sayings, one ancient, one modern, which you say capture the attempt of the Vietnamese peasant to influence fate, and yet also capture the futility of trying to do that. Would you share those two things with us? They are really something that gave me great pause and are really useful in terms of trying to get some perception of what it was like to be living this day and night existence.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first goes, sell distant kin, buy close neighbors. And that really goes back from the very beginnings of the Viet people, when their country began to stretch and elongate into that long, narrow shape, so that there was already a movement, a natural migration from north into the South as the South was populated. So kin became ever more distant. And then when the war divides, turns into a civil war, it's North against South, and then the Viet Cong are infiltrating every level of society. So to survive, you have to buy off those who are close to you. You have to buy your close neighbors. The other thing, which I think just evokes the whole taste of what it was like to live in the war, is this. The average peasant, under conditions of the war, is caught between the sticky rice and the bean. You take a pile of glutinous white rice grains, a pile of black beans, put them on a banana leaf, mix them up, cover it up, and steam it. Open up the banana leaf, and what you have is you can see the glutinous stickiness of the white rice, the stickiness of the bean, the white and the black, but you cannot separate it. The peasant is caught between the two. The white rice is the daylight and the government side. The black bean is the Viet Cong and the night side. So you have to try to stay between them, to live your life between them. And as I would write later in the book, I say you if you lean to any side, you lean to the side that harasses you less.
Mm-hmm.
And this came as a shock to Kim. She swore her parents. She would say to me, my parents, and she's an adult now. She's in her 30s. But she's never given voice to the war. Same with her parents going to be in Vietnam. They have never given voice to the war, their experiences. So Kim repeats to me a childhood view she had, that her parents never cared for the war, that they were just but peasants. She had no idea of, in fact, the torment of her parents.
What has this book meant for Kim Phuc? Not to realize so much of what was happening until it appeared.
In some ways, this mirrors the experience of other South Vietnamese who have come up to me and told me in the book, after reading the book, that, you know, the closer you are to war, I write, the less you know about what is going on, which is just a matter of survival. If you don't know what's going on, you can't therefore betray family, friends, neighbors. So you just do what it takes. You keep your head down when you have to. So Kim, who is burdened by her suffering, then reads the book. As I expected, she wept, and she was in shock. Read not only about the trials of the Viet Cong, but even, for example, that her mother was once arrested and tortured by the South Vietnamese government. What it does for Kim, I think, is it opened up her view of suffering and shared the burden. So she saw, yes, you know, she has the physical suffering, she's paid for it, but she's found her redemption. But there is so much suffering in other ways of the war. And when she saw, she said, for example, how her mother suffered, she felt that her mother had, even in just reading about it, that had helped take away, again, her own pain.
There are a number of occasions in the book where you quote Kim Phuc as saying, only my mother suffers more.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, you know, when she was still quite young and she was battling with all kinds of pain, as she continues to do to this day.
One of the most poignant moments I had when I interviewed her mother in Vietnam, and this is under very difficult conditions in Vietnam, because I've had to do all my research clandestinely, because Kim is persona non grata there. Every time I showed the mother a picture of Kim, the mother would begin to silently weep. And we would say nothing, but in those tears are, you know, let me think of as a writer, they're just paragraphs of emotion. Then the poignant moment came when I said to the mother about her life, which was really constant piling up of work to try and keep the family afloat on the strength of her noodle making and rice paper making. She's separated. She can't, doesn't even live with the family in their home and not even build. She just has her bare cotton, her bare cot to sleep on at night, a one nail for her clothes. And she says to me, and she weeps, she says, "We never even had time to miss my children." And so there, to me, just encapsulated the strength of her sacrifice.
Mm. You write early in the book that her work was so demanding to keep the family going that some nights she just went without food. She would just, the day would start over again.
Mm-hmm. She had to be out sometimes. She had to be out usually by 1:30 in the morning, get to the market in the pre-dawn, and then chop and cut and pre-cook vegetables and so on in time to raise the bamboo curtain for 5 a.m. Well, the father... But this is not the slur it's meant to be, but he would come off as a bit of a ne'er-do-well. But it's not the slur it's meant, it sounds, because in the culture at the time, for a peasant, the status of the family was raised if the father was seen to lead a life of leisure, drink tea, play a game of cards, read a classic or two, share a cigarette, while the women were the beasts of burden laboring in the fields. So Kim's family, through the dint of her mother's hard work, had the status of being the third richest peasant in Trondheim. Mm. Until, of course, the calamity of war eventually mm-hmm. takes it all from mm-hmm. them.
Well, he's a very loving father. I mean, he sat with her mm-hmm. after she was burned so severely, day and night in the hospital.
Yes, he's determined... As he sits in Saigon and back home in Trondheim, mortar fire is pounding the village and bombs still are dropped. He is at her bedside determined not to miss. At first he thinks he doesn't want to miss the moment she slips from life, but once she is going to live, he's determined that she will not miss the moment that she opens her eyes, and he doesn't.
Denise Chung is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of The Girl in the Picture, The Story of Kim Phuc, The Photograph, and the Vietnam War. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, your questions are welcome in Champaign. Anywhere else, toll free, 1-800-222-9455. June 8, 1972. What happened on that date?
On that morning, journalists in the foreign press corps in Saigon exchange rumor about where that day's fighting is, and they hear that, yes, up at Tran Bang, 30 miles up Route 1, there's a firefight going on. But they've heard firefights hundreds of times in Viet Cong. They come up from the tunnels in the jungle, cut off Route 1 to disrupt transport and communication to Saigon, and then fade back into the jungle. Well, the journalists head up. They come to concertina barbed wire stretched across the highway. It's 3 days of traffic blocked, a roadblock. In the distance, they can tell by the smoke swirling that there's a ground assault going on and airstrikes against entrenched Viet Cong. They see a temple in the background, but they don't know that that's where women and children are hiding, guarded by a contingent of South Vietnamese soldiers. They walk all morning long, airstrikes. A first plane comes in and drops hard bombs to blow the cover off bunkers. A second plane comes in and drops napalm, jellied gasoline. And the idea of that is to suffocate, if not burn anything, still alive. But then it's noon, and it begins to rain. And it's a tropical rain, so it gets heavier. The cloud cover gets lower. And the airstrikes have stopped. There's silence in the skies. The journalists look at their watches and say, well, they know there's one rule of the Vietnam War. You hightail it back to Saigon before darkness, before the sun sets and the Viet Cong take over. But they decide they'll leave it out a bit longer, and then unexpectedly after lunch, the sun peeks through. And in this mud-still, dirty sky, unexpectedly, the journalists hear the drone of an airplane. A first plane comes in, drops hard bombs. They turn out to be duds. A second plane comes in to drop napalm. The soldiers guarding the women and children in the temple mistakenly think the napalm is intended for the temple. In panic, they send the women and children running out for their lives and the soldiers joining them. There was one rule of engagement during the Vietnam War, which the Americans brought in, feeling unease that this was a war where friend and foe loved alike. Civilians were not fair game unless they were running. If running, they could be deemed to be Viet Cong. So from that, in that dirty, smudged sky, the South Vietnamese pilot carrying the napalm sees these figures on the road, drops his napalm. And out of that comes two groups of survivors. In the first is an old lady, Kim's grandmother, carrying a charred 3-year-old boy, Kim's cousin. The horror of it has the journalists, and I'm talking about Time, Life magazine, television networks, snapping away, photographing this to record that old woman and the horribly burned boy. They do not expect the second group of survivors, and when Kim Phuc comes running out, only Nick Ut has one frame left in his camera.
You write that most war correspondents will be caught in friendly fire, mm-hmm. but then you write, but rarely do casualties come walking into view while journalists like an audience are waiting for something to happen. How has this day affected those journalists, in particular Nick Ut?
Nick is still tormented, I would say, by the war. The journalists at the time did not know that this would become such a famous moment. And freezes that frame. Of course, she just keeps running and she disappears eventually down the road. So that when I catch up with these journalists afterwards, and I have, you know, playthings of my children, and I'm trying to reenact the napalm attack, in fact, they all give me different versions of that event. So it's not seared in their memory like the photograph is. But Nick cannot get out of his mind's eye the red of the napalm, the heat of it, and he still has nightmares about it. And when every time I have ever spoken to Nick, both of us, now, he physically bears scars from his own war coverage. He's got a thigh that bothers him from shrapnel. He only got his job because his older brother was killed as a photographer for the same outfit, AP, in a battle in the Mekong. Nick has his family left behind, and he goes to Vietnam, and he still feels he can't talk openly about the experience of war. So Nick still remains, I would say, and he would admit it, tormented by that war and the images that are just burned onto his mind.
You mentioned a minute ago that because these people were running, the pilot continued to drop napalm. What was the rule of engagement regarding how it was that a bombing strike could be called in on a village in South Vietnam at all? Why were these planes in the area?
Well, Viet Cong were entrenched and trying to cut. They had undertaken an action to cut and take control of the highway, so traffic is disrupted in and out of Saigon. But you really have to go back to this is a guerrilla war. So the Viet Cong had infiltrated. They could be the next-door neighbor. I mean, sons and daughters would disappear from families. Where had they gone? They'd gone to the jungle to join the Viet Cong. Even in Saigon, they had infiltrated government. So this, and even the media. So this is a war where you're fighting right in the village. And there are famous images and television footage from the Vietnam War of which Marines took part in, of going in to rout out Viet Cong. And this is a ground up, a ground assault, where the Viet Cong are in the village, and yes, South Vietnamese military leadership and American leadership, if they got information on so-called intelligence that some place was a Viet Cong stronghold, then they called in mortar rounds. They dropped, they called in airstrikes.
Stick your rice in the bean.
Mm-hmm.
Kim, of course, is not going to be
No, up until the end of the war, when the Barsky unit was in there, Dr. Arthur Barsky, who came to save the shooting Hiroshima victims in New York, they kept tally of how many child victims there were. It numbered even in the tens of thousands or more, even 100,000. But this is but a guesstimate. If you go to Saigon and out into the villages of Vietnam, you will see maimed adults. You will see who apparently don't really have any medical care. So Kim's victimhood is not apparent. You if she wears long sleeves, keeps her hair long, you would in fact never even know. And because Vietnam at the end of the war divided into the society of the victor and the vanquished. And when I go to Vietnam 20, 25 years on, and to my dismay, I find it still so, those victims of war, they don't pop their heads up. So I think that has been a bit of that, except in individual humanitarian gestures that some people just doggedly persisted after the end of the war to try and get humanitarian aid to Vietnam. And sometimes I was, as a writer, I was just overcome with anguish that there were so many other victims out there who never get medical attention. But of course, in this book, this is about the most famous victim.
How is it that people were able to survive? You said that there are survivors who suffered more than she, but
well, the miracle of her of that she lived in when in fact napalm victims really make it to hospital, because they die usually within a half hour because the napalm is burned so intensively. The miracle of the survival was that she got to a hospital. She was a wealthy peasant from the well-fed, so she had the resources to survive those critical first 72 hours. But yes, then she becomes a burn victim who suffers from the scars of severe burn. There are other victims who just could be victims from shrapnel, from stepping on a landmine, from malnutrition, who never get medical attention, don't get medical attention. And so have suffered deformities, maybe have lost an eye, have never had corrective surgery.
And it was Nick Oot who took her to the hospital.
Yes. He's torn by his does is drops her en route to Saigon.
You mentioned early on in the interview how Kim Phuc is a very religious woman. Talk with us, if you would, about her conversion to Christianity.
It's all the more remarkable because she does it in decree. State censorship is removed, books on religion from libraries. Churches are closed down. It's viewed as something corrupt from the West. Kim converts when the depth of her suffering is more than she can take. And that suffering, and this is when I came to really understand suffering, was when I turned my mind away from the physical suffering and understood the mental suffering that she was going through, when her life was no longer hers. And some of this is evident among the South Vietnamese people when losing the war, they feel that they have no future, and it's feeling fling themselves into the South China Sea to the mercy of pirates and sharks, and hoping, of course, then they become the boat people. She doesn't have the money. Her parents don't have the gold for bribery. They've never grown up near the ocean. She can't swim and swim her way out of it. So then she gets undermined. Well, she needs to get out, and her out, she finds her solace in her when she meets someone who converts her to Christianity. And in that conversion, therefore, she sees the hope of redemption. And I think it's human nature to seek redemption.
Hmm. Her family, her parents, have they converted, or are they still practitioners of Cao Dai?
Kronbach was, of course, very close to the actual seat of the Cao Dai religion, or in other words, the Holy See. That would be like the Vatican. So they inherited that religion from their own parents. They now live with Kim in outside Toronto, and only the beginning of the week did her parents see the word that they could have landed immigrant status in Canada. So now Canada will be their home. They won't go back to Vietnam. When I met them in Vietnam, they were living in a bamboo hut that was a bit of a heft from one hand I could have knocked over. So now they're living in this townhouse, and I say this with some sadness because they're isolated from Vietnamese culture. They have Kim, they have the grandchildren. They do go to Kim's church. This makes Kim very happy, she says to me. You know, her parents have found peace. Well, I have to, you know, tell tales that to say that I taught my own relationship with a mother. I believe the mother is deeply Cao Daiist, and it's just that there is no alternative. In her heart of hearts, she is wedded to her religion, and not to this what you know Kim would call this religion.
Around Toronto, is there a community of people from Vietnam?
Yes, it again goes. And there's Vietnamese, you know, cable television, there's radio, there are publications. But Kim lives quite some distance from that, outside of Toronto. Community is beginning to make gestures towards Kim, partly helped by reading this book. Some of us said to me, well, we understand she is a victim like all of us. But Kim's integration in that community was marred because of rumor when she first arrived. The girl in the picture had defected, but there was immediate suspicion. Why had she taken so long to defect? Could she be here sent as a spy for the regime? Why is she here so? Why did she defect so late? She must have had all sorts of resources available to her and means to leave. Why has she left all the Kim kept her distance from anybody Vietnamese when she first arrived because she was trying impossibly to live a life in obscurity, hoping no one would discover that she had been the girl in the picture.
Because it only meant
that she would be thrust into the public eye, that she would be, you know, have to satisfy the public's appetite for her story. you, Philip.
Denise Chan has been our guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine. I'm sorry to say that we have to leave it here. There's so much more in this book. The Girl in the Picture, the Story of Kim Phuc, the Photograph, and the Vietnam War. Denise Chan, the author. The book is published by Viking.